Film Spotting is brought to you by Spout.com. In January, Spout.com will present Butterknife, a new generation detective series made by a new generation of filmmakers. Find out more at butterknife.spout.com.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Matty Robinson. This week, there won't be blood. Not this week, anyway. But we will spend a few minutes discussing Walk Hard, the Dewey Cox story, and pay one last tribute to 2007 with our top five discoveries, disappointments, and more, including our picks for the worst movies of the year.
Plus, listener feedback, Massacre Theater, and new music from Chuck Prophet. But first, a review of perhaps the scariest movie of 2007, The Orphanage, actually El Orfanato, which I think is a lot more fun to say, Maddie. It's a Spanish ghost story about a woman who returns to the abandoned manor home she left when she was adopted as a child 30 years before. Laura and her husband Carlos plan to turn the home into a center for special needs children until their 7-year-old son, Simone, who enjoys playing games with his 5 not-so-imaginary friends, disappears without a trace. Now, Maddie, I think it's probably impossible to watch The Orphanage without reflecting on other films and books with similar themes and settings. The Shining, The Others, Poltergeist even gets something of an homage with a fantastically spooky seance sequence. The psychological suspense of Turn of the Screw comes to mind, and of course, the story that screenwriter Sergio Sanchez and director J.A. Bayona directly reference throughout the film, Peter Pan. But the film that is guaranteed to always come up in any discussion of The Orphanage, for better or worse, is Guillermo del Toro's Pan's Labyrinth. Both are Spanish-language movies that deal with characters caught between the real world and an alternate imaginary or supernatural world, and it's del Toro's name that appears first in the credits here, serving as presenter and producer. If I recall, Pan's Labyrinth was your favorite film of 2006, am I right?
Yeah.
Did The Orphanage thrill you as well?
Well, I think it's actually too bad that Bayona has to answer so many questions about the del Toro connection here, mm-hmm. because they're completely different films. Labyrinth really worked for me, Pan's Labyrinth, not the David Bowie film, mm-hmm. really worked for me more as a fantasy and also as a war film rather than as a horror film or a suspense film. I really liked the fable and the fantasy before that, which was really well done.
Sure.
This film actually is more comparable to, I think, del Toro's 2001 work, I don't know if you've seen it, The Devil's Backbone.
I have not.
Which is also set in an orphanage during the Spanish Revolution. I was cursing your name yesterday because, as you know, I do not see these kinds of films mm-hmm. in the theater. And I went with my friend Sam and his wife Carrie, and we saw The Diving Bell and the Butterfly. And there was a preview for this film, for The Orphanage, which I was going to see later in the day. I could not get my head out of that preview. I was so terrified. And it's not even that I'm a scaredy cat. Well, maybe mm-hmm. I just am. I mean, I cried at Turner and Hooch. But the fact of the matter is, I just don't like it when something's going to jump out at me. I can't concentrate. I can't concentrate on anything in the film, and there's mm-hmm. just no enjoyment for me. I have to watch these films on my own terms. I'm in the comfort of my couch, snuggled up with somebody in a sweatshirt. And even that said, there are a couple films that I can't even do that with. You mentioned them. The Shining, The Exorcist. I call those—
I'm with you.
I call those my fridge films. Have you seen Friends, where David Schwimmer's character, or no, it's Joey's character, The Shining, the book is so scary that he has to put it in the freezer when it gets to the really scary parts? So I can now add this trailer and this movie to my fridge list.
That's good.
It is absolutely terrifying.
Yeah, it really is. And obviously you are saying that is a positive thing, though.
Yeah.
Yeah, when you saw it in the theater, it did work. And it did definitely work for me as well. This is the first movie I saw at the Toronto Film Festival. And I was really shocked to find after the fact that this is the first film for both the director and the screenwriter, because I think the directing especially is so assured here. It's so clear that Bayona mm-hmm. had every frame of this film in his mind, and yet I don't think it feels stifled at all. There's a real grace to the way the camera moves through the hallways of the orphanage, and he just lets everything take its time unfolding without trying to jump us from one scare to the next. And you talked about that. You don't want those kind of moments where you have to jump out of your seat or those gotcha moments. And I think the best compliment I can pay to this film is that it's not really scary in a traditional sense or full of those big jump-out-of-your-seats moments. I just think it's chilling. There are a couple sequences here that had me squirming in my seat, and it's what I really loved about it, except for one kind of gotcha moment that I won't give away and I think totally works. The suspense is all psychological and requires us to fill in the blanks that we don't really want to fit in. Geraldine Chaplin, for example, I referenced the Poltergeist kind of homage in this film. Geraldine Chaplin shows up during this seance, or I'm not even sure that's the right word, this kind of summoning, this psychic encounter.
Right, okay.
Yeah. She's in this scene, and she is amazing. And again, we're just watching her through monitors. We don't know what she's seeing or hearing. We have to imagine it, and it's terrifying.
Yeah, you're right. You hit the nail right on the head. There must be a formula to these kinds of films, and he gets every single note. The music in this film is terrific because you're exactly right. He plays the beats just right.
Mm-hmm.
And this movie plays with you, just as the invisible kids play with the protagonist in this film.
Yeah.
It really plays with you because it does tease itself as this horror film, as this woman being terrorized by these invisible ghosts, but it's not. There is a mystery, and that comes along at the end, and I really, really enjoy it. So you don't really know what you're watching.
Yeah.
You're just scared out of your wits.
Yeah, and I do think that maybe when you get to the end, if you really think about the ending of the film, it could be troubling on a number of levels, and I do think that the way the mystery and all those pieces
come
together...
Well, that's my question for you, because did you see it twice?
I have seen it twice now.
Now, how does it hold up on a second viewing?
It's great. It's even better, but maybe you are a little bit more aware of what exactly is going on with the story, and it's not as satisfying in terms of the pieces
the
of the plot.
Because the story is not that strong.
Yeah, no, it really does feel kind of cobbled together from all those other films we talked about. I mean, there is a mystery there that, while interesting, I'm not sure it adds up to anything in a satisfying way with the rest of this ghost story.
Yeah.
It's just kind of there, and it feels out of place. But the fact is, I was so caught up in the acting. Baleen Rueda, the star of this film as Laura, is incredible. Her son.
And the husband.
Yeah, the husband is good, though. Obviously, he gets to kind of be the wet blanket, so there's not as much to it.
Yeah, but I liked it, though. He didn't play a stereotypical wet blanket,
He's decent. And the son, I think, is really good, too. Roger Princep is his name. The 7-year-old boy is amazing. And then the direction, like I talked about. There's just an elegance to this film that I can't wait to see what he does next. And I have to say, speaking of what's coming next, I had a really great opportunity about a month ago to have lunch with J.A. Bayona and Sergio Sanchez, the screenwriter and director of this film. I don't know if we even talked about this, Maddie, but
very cool.
I had a chance to have lunch with them in Chicago here downtown. And unfortunately, or fortunately, I should say, only 5 or 6 other critics showed up. So it was a really intimate affair. And it turns out I sit down at a table. They haven't arrived yet. And I'm kind of nervous because what am I going to say to them? Am I even going to get a chance to really talk to them? Or are they going to be across the room? They walk in and sit right next to me. Bayona's right next to me. Couldn't be a nicer, more unassuming guy. Not this pretentious filmmaker at all. Like, maybe I thought, because he's so good, I kind of thought maybe he'd be like a Alejandro Gonzalez Iñárritu, this guy who just screams, I'm a director, I'm an artist, you know? And he's just the nicest guy. He comes in and sits next to me. Sanchez is next to him. And I had a chance to really talk to Bayona one-on-one as this thing went on. And of course, right away, people did start asking about Pan's Labyrinth. And I did feel sorry for him because I didn't want to touch on the obvious question, but then it is there. You can't avoid it. There are similarities. And the fact is, they do owe the release of this film and some of the attention it's getting to the success of Pan's Labyrinth, and they certainly don't shy away from that. But what they're tired of, as you might imagine, is people saying, you only made this movie as kind of a knockoff of Pan's Labyrinth. They started working on this, according to Sanchez, I believe like 10 years ago in different forms. So it certainly wasn't something they just decided to capitalize on Pan's Labyrinth. But I just want to say the one really interesting thing that I thought came out of this lunch is I asked him about some of the scenes from the film, and I asked him about his influences. What influenced him with this film, and it's something that maybe I don't think a lot of people would think of when they watch The Orphanage, and it's actually Close Encounters of the Third Kind. He loves Spielberg, and he had his cast and crew watch Close Encounters before filming, because again, it's that story of one character's obsession derailing this family. And that really is what the film was about to him, his family in that way. And I thought that was really interesting.
Well, I also think it speaks to the superior storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, Close Encounters has Spielberg, one of the greatest storytellers of the 20th century. And we talked about this a little bit with No Country for Old Men. When you feel so safe and so comfortable with
every
the Coen brothers,
right.
You just know they're going to hit everything exactly. And within this genre, I think Bayona knows exactly what he's doing.
He does. Here's the bad side, though. Here's the bad news from my meeting with him. He told me that this film was going to be remade. I believe New Line plans to remake it here in English. He is not directing it. And he was told, we really love the film, but we think the scares are too subtle. we think it needs to be bigger. I mean, it's like a cliche, like something you take out of some movie mocking Hollywood. They've literally said to him, it's really good as it is, but you know what? We just need to pump up the intensity of it
and
make
it
really
big. Saw 5 here.
Basically, that's exactly it. And that would destroy, really, the elegance of this film. The fact that it doesn't work on that level, that it doesn't try to manipulate you and get you with these big scares. It really
you
is
will
the
be
psychological.
Terrified, though. Let's not, you know,
yeah,
let's
no,
not
you
miss
will.
Words.
But again, I think when you really think later about what you were so scared about, it's the camera moving slightly and you not knowing what's going to be in the shot. You know, those kind of quick pans or even slow pans, those shots really are amazing in this movie. So I agree. I'm really glad that you had a good time with it. I know that you, like me, we're not big horror guys. We do get scared. I don't know if it was something from our childhood, we're traumatized or something, but...
Well, I some of my favorite films are horror films, Halloween and The Thing, but I have to watch them on my own terms. Mm-hmm. I can't sit there in the theater. It's just too claustrophobic.
Well, this is a really good film, and you should see it now before Hollywood gets its hands
all
over it.
It's a hell of a lot of fun. Go check it out.
The Orphanage is out now in limited release, and it's scheduled to go wide Friday, January 11th. If you've seen it already or plan to see The Orphanage and you agree or disagree with our takes, or if you have any other thoughts you'd like to share, email us at feedback@filmspotting.net. Or leave us a voicemail, 206-203-2463.
All right, time for a quick break. Up next, Adam and I walk hard with Chicago's own John C. Reilly and reveal our most overrated movies of the year. Stay with us.
I like the way you freckle. I like the way you peel. I love to see your hair in a mess. It's been a long September. It's gonna be a long winter. Let me help you out of that dress before you catch a cold. Uh-oh. We're rising and we're falling, falling and we're rising, lost on the invisible sea. A thousand stolen kisses, a crime without a witness. Throw me overboard, Captain, would you please? I just can't stand myself.
From the guy who brought you Talladega Nights and Superbad.
You have got to give up this dream. You're never gonna make it.
And maybe you don't believe in me after all.
I do believe in you. I just know you're gonna fail.
Columbia Pictures presents The Epic Journey.
Walking to the top of a mountain ain't easy. It's a long, hard walk.
But I will walk hard. Of the man who became a legend.
Walk hard.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Maddie and Adam. I'm Maddie. He's Adam. That was a clip from the new biopic spoof, Walk Hard, the Dewey Cox story. Adam, you and I, of course, love the star of this film, John C. Reilly. We're big fans of Judd Apatow, one of the writers behind this film, a spoof basically of musical biopics, primarily Walk the Line, the Johnny Cash story. It's been a pretty light season for comedies lately. Outside of Juno, we've been spending a lot of time with some pretty heavy films. So, you know, there's a reason, of course, at the Dionysia that the ancient Greeks, they would play a succession of tragedies. They'd follow up those tragedies with a satyr play. People, of course, aching to laugh and to have the material they just saw spoofed. So the simple question to you, Mr. Kempinar, did John C. Reilly manage to successfully mock what we here take so deathly seriously? And more importantly, did you laugh?
This is what you have to love about Film Spotting. You'll get a discussion on Walk Hard with references to Dionysus. I love it. So he successfully mocked it, that's for sure. Did I laugh? Yes, I laughed just enough to recommend seeing Walk Hard, but I can't say it was the transcendent comedic experience I had hoped for coming into this film. And comedies, we have high expectations for them. This happens with Talladega Nights, another John C. Reilly film, and even Borat was a movie I was underwhelmed with. Maybe I go in expecting too much from these comedies, but I do have to agree with some of our listeners who have already written in about this film. Of course, it opened over the Christmas holiday, and Edwin in Brevard, North Carolina, wrote in and said, I went in thinking that it was going to be the next great comedy, but I came out disappointed. John C. Reilly does all he can with the character, and the songs are spot-on parodies, but most of the film feels more like not another teen movie than Spinal Tap.
He hit it exactly on the head. That's what I have here right in my notes, but because before the movie, there was a preview for Epic Movie, another one of these genre-spoofing films. The problem is, what that is, it's joke-based rather than plot-based comedy.
Or character-based.
Exactly. And it reminded me, did you read Mad Magazine as a kid?
Not really.
Basically, those spoofs, you know, of Star Trek becomes Star Black, and you have those great illustrations by Tom Davis.
That, yeah.
That's about 3 pages of material, because that's all it can sustain.
Right.
Here, if the jokes don't land, the audience doesn't have anybody to attach to because you've given up on the story. It's just joke after joke after joke. And if the jokes don't land, you are up a creek.
And that is exactly what is wrong with this film. It does run out of steam. There's no doubt about that. And there is no story to hold on to. I give you that. I do agree as well with one other listener. I want to read Brooks Robertson here in San Francisco. He said, from the beginning flashback to the scenes in the 60s where they pretty much tell you explicitly, this is the 60s. That's why we're dressed like this. It was a great achievement in spoofdom, but overall this movie just wasn't that funny. The joke of John C. Reilly and Kristen Wiig playing teenagers was barely funny the first time, and it never got funnier.
No.
The idea of cutting people in half was not funny the first time and worse the second time. He says, Walk Hard missed by a lot, and I cannot recommend it beyond saying it was a really successful spoof. He's absolutely right, but Maddie, where I will disagree with him is I will say that it's worth seeing for the conviction that John C. Reilly and Jenna Fisher bring to their roles. And let's face
it's not worth seeing.
I'm really just moderately saying it's worth seeing because of their performances. And if you've seen Ray or Walk the Line, the opening scene of the movie where Dewey and his brother Nate go out to play and the brother says, ain't nothing horrible going to happen today.
Right.
That's
but
hilarious.
But he says something to that effect about 5 times.
It's
and
funny,
that's why
though.
No, it really
It was
doesn't.
Funny the first time.
And you know what the greatest sin of this movie is that it turned some of my favorite actors I turned against them.
Really?
You've got Raymond J. Barry playing the dad, Pa Cox, who went to Brown, by the way.
Okay.
Basically spoofing Robert Patrick's performance in Walk the Line. He's
not very good.
He shows up every 5 years to say, wrong kid died.
It's not funny.
I don't get it. And any movie that can make me dislike Paul Rudd, that Beatles scene was terrible.
You're insane.
That Beatles scene
you're
was
insane.
Terrible.
No, that was one of the funniest moments
you know
of
who,
the year.
You know the only saving grace in that scene is Justin Long.
All
the
four
Matt
of them?
Kid. No.
Justin Long as George Harrison, I agree,
that was some
was
of
the
most
best.
Heavy-handed satire ever. It did not work, Adam.
I don't mind the heavy hand there. Actually, Maddie, you've set us up perfectly. I want to play just a quick clip from that scene. What Maddie says is terrible. What I say is one of the funniest things I heard in 2007. Here is a scene. This is Jack Black, Paul Rudd, Justin Long, and Jason Schwartzman doing the Beatles.
We're nothing but grains of sand.
That was freaking transcendental, Paul McCartney. Don't you agree, John Lennon?
Yes, Dewey Cox. With meditation, there's no limit to what we can imagine.
What do you think, George Harrison, of the Beatles?
I don't know. You know, I'm just trying to get some more songs on the album. You know.
And as Ringo Starr, I'm not so interested in meditation. I just like to have fun.
I like the little one.
Now, that's just a small bit of it there. I don't want to ruin it for anyone else who is going to go see this film.
What are you
it's
ruining?
Comic
You're not
gold.
Ruining? No, oh my God.
Every impression, the voices are great, especially Justin Long. His George
no,
Harrison
he
is dead on.
He's dead on, but the others are just so over the top. It's
that's
not
what's funny about it.
It's not
yes,
funny.
It is.
No, it's not.
Paul Rudd looking to the camera and saying, imagine that way, was funny.
No, it wasn't.
I thought it was.
I was cringing.
I can't
I was
believe
cringing.
You would cringe at that scene, my favorite scene in the film.
Wow.
I think it's worth seeing for that scene.
No.
Though you can
Are you
watch
serious?
It on YouTube and then just avoid the film altogether. I know it's out there somewhere.
You know, I thought the best spoof in the whole film was actually the John C. Reilly as Bob Dylan.
Yeah,
I like
that. Good.
I thought that was a good, you know, again, 14 seconds of material that landed.
Yeah.
The whole rest of the film, especially the Beatles, didn't work.
Right. And watching it in the theater, I did notice other people around me during that scene totally losing interest, looking around at some of us who were laughing, thinking, what's going on here? Obviously, if you haven't seen Don't Look Back or don't really know the Dylan era stuff, that's going to miss. You know, this is a film where I think you have to get some of the
Bob
references.
Dylan.
Maybe. Speaking of Dylan and hearing those songs, I do want to mention that Dan Byrne, one of the artists that we play here on Film Spotting from time to time, he wrote or co-wrote like 11 songs in this film, including 2 of the really prominently featured tunes. Speaking of Dylan, Let Me Hold You, Little Man. It's a great bit in the film. And Beautiful Ride, the song we hear at the end, Dan Byrne was involved in those. But you're absolutely right. It completely runs out of steam. I think that's par for the course with parodies like this. I know people bring up Saturday Night Live comparisons a lot of the time, especially when you're talking about films featuring Saturday Night Live members, as this one does. But it really is, and you touched on this, a case where there's about 10 minutes, maybe 30 minutes of really great material here. Stretch it out over 85 to 90, and it becomes tiresome. It absolutely does.
Yeah, and it's funny because Kristen Wiig, who is on Saturday Night Live right now,
and funny.
Is really funny because she's playing it straight. And John C. Reilly is trying to play it as straight as possible, mm-hmm. but unfortunately they just don't have the material here.
Okay, well, we only disagree slightly on this film. I thought it was a little bit funnier than you. We disagree in a big way about that Beatles scene, though.
Oh,
and
God.
We'll just have to agree to disagree on that.
2008.
That was
Ouch,
great.
Adam.
Our first big fight, Maddie. Okay, well, let's move on to our poll questions then. Let's actually start with our poll question for this week. You can go to filmspotting.net and vote in this poll. And we mentioned at the top of the show that we're not reviewing There Will Be Blood on this show, the new Paul Thomas Anderson film. We'd hoped to, but we're actually going to put it off until next week. It opens this weekend. And I know many listeners, Maddie, like to listen to the show after they've seen the film. I actually think this is a good thing. It'll be maybe a more interesting discussion for many of our listeners to have seen the film. So There Will Be Blood next week with Daniel Day-Lewis. Our question for you is, I most want to see There Will Be Blood because...
A, I love Paul Thomas Anderson. B, I love me some Daniel Day-Lewis. C, I love critics who love it. D, I love period pieces about oil and religion. E, all of the above. F, no blood for me, thanks.
Knowing you, Maddie, I know you're going with D. You love period pieces about oil and religion.
Yeah. I love me some Daniel Day-Lewis.
Really?
I'm not a big Paul Thomas Anderson fan.
Okay. Well, I'm going A. If I was voting and had I not seen the film, which I actually have, it actually made my top 10 films of the year, so you know where I stand a little bit, I would have voted A. I'm a big Paul Thomas Anderson fan, and so that would have been my biggest reason to go see the film. But let us know what you think. Go to filmspotting.net and make your voice heard. Let's go back then to last week's poll question. We've actually had it up for a couple weeks here over the holiday on filmspotting.net. We wanted to know which of these acclaimed films is the most overrated of 2007. Your choices were The Bourne Ultimatum, Knocked Up, Michael Clayton, No Country for Old Men, and Ratatouille. All films that have gotten a lot of critical acclaim, almost universally adored, so that's why we chose them. We wanted to know which one you think is the most overrated, and how did it come out, Maddie?
Well, actually, I wasn't that surprised by the results, mm-hmm. because number one was Knocked Up at 36%, Michael Clayton second at 22%, Ratatouille third at 19%, The Bourne Ultimatum with 15%, and nice to see coming in last, No Country for Old Men at 8%.
I agree. I'm glad that did finish last. You actually did vote for Knocked Up. You liked the film, just didn't love it. Mm-hmm. It was your pick. A little bit overrated. If I recall
correctly.
You
went with Clayton, right?
I went with Michael Clayton, though it was close with Ratatouille, and this actually does perfectly set up the first installment of our top five roundup here, our last look back at the year 2007. We're going to get into a lot more of these here later in the show, but let's go ahead and start with the movies, Maddie, we thought were the most overrated of the year. What do you got?
Okay, these are my most overrated films of the year. Number three, a film that you had a lot of love for. I don't know what you were smoking when you saw that, and that was Craig Brewer's Black Snake Moan. I love
crazy.
The audacity of Craig Brewer. I just think this one falls flat. Number two, The Host, that Korean
mm-hmm.
horror
Bong
film.
Joon-ho.
I didn't quite understand all the clamor about that one. And number one, we've sort of discussed it ad nauseum here, The Savages.
Mm-hmm, that's true. Laura Linney, Philip Seymour Hoffman in that film. My overrated list, I've got five of them here I'm going to mention. And I want to say, I did like all four of these films. The first four that you're going to hear, I liked them. I think they're absolutely worth seeing. Not all great by any means, but worth seeing. So this is obviously least to most overrated, Sweeney Todd. We liked it, but if you look at
wow,
the acclaim
most,
it's getting,
really?
I'm just saying, if you look at the acclaim it's getting, no one is negative about this film, and I think we were both a little more lukewarm on it than most
but
critics.
But I think it's a solid entry for both Depp and Burton.
I do, too. I'm just saying, in the grand scheme of things, overrated, critics are going crazy for it. I don't think it's a masterpiece, so it's my number five. Ratatouille, a 96 score on Metacritic. I think it's a good film, again, worth seeing. Not one of the best films of the year for me. It's my number four choice. Michael Clayton, again, another solid movie. I liked it, but most critics are loving it, so it's my number three. I'm with you on The Host, another film I liked, I gave a positive recommendation to, but don't see how it could be on anyone's top 10 list of the year. Didn't think it was that impressive. And then The Savages, the one film here that not only is adored, but yes, we both actually hated this film.
Yeah.
I don't know what we missed on the movie The Savages. I'm not entirely sure. I know I wasn't a big fan of Laura Linney's performance. I did like Philip Seymour Hoffman, like what he was trying to do with the material, but that film, it's trying to be a dark comedy and it's trying to be funny. Yeah. It didn't make me laugh. at all.
That was its ultimate sin. Philip Bosco, also really good in it.
Wasted, unfortunately, as the father in that film. So, again, though, The Savages, that's the one film maybe that we at some point are going to have to take a step back and reevaluate and see if we really were crazy on. But right now, for both of us, it's our number one most overrated movie of the year. And again, we'll get into some of our underrated films of the year and a lot more later in the show.
All right, time for another quick break. When we return, Massacre Theater and your feedback on the best performances and films of the year. Stay with us.
A nerdy kid, an army brat, a small town girl in a big city flat. She's got a new life down the road a few. She traded in her clothes, bought something new.
Small town.
You're right, I sprung it on you.
Well, it's not that bad. It's just loose, like, you know the part with the gun and the blood?
All right.
And the guy, shooting up, and then they...
If I can change it, I'll let you know in 5 minutes.
Well, thank you, sir.
Thank you.
You know, in a lot of ways, I think we're a little bit alike.
Welcome back to Film Spotting. It's time now for Massacre Theater, the part of the show where Adam and I massacre a beloved screenplay and you, the listener, get a shot at a free DVD. Now, last week, Adam and I massacred the scene you just heard with Bill Murray and the legendary Bobcat Goldthwait from Scrooge, to tie in, of course, with Christmas.
That's right. It was Christmas, so we chose Scrooge. Maybe not It's a Wonderful Life or A Christmas Story, but to many of our listeners and to me, it is definitely a classic in its own right. And, of course, you did choose to do the scene as Christopher Walken instead of Bobcat Goldthwait. And Ben Pfeiffer in Louisville, Kentucky, nailed it, Maddie. He wrote in and said, here's why I think you decided to do it as Walken. You guys picked the scene, and Maddie saw an opportunity to do a Goldthwait impression. Only every time he tries, he ends up sounding like Christopher Walken. Finally, in frustration, he says, screw it, and decides to do it as Walken. I only bring this up, Maddie, because behind your Walken, I could hear a little Goldthwait trying to get out. He's dead on, isn't
very
he?
Very good. Very, very well done. I used to do Goldthwait when I was a kid. I grew up just idolizing those Police Academy movies, mm-hmm. so I used to do them. I don't know where it happened. What happened?
But your Christopher Walken was very good. Hopefully, we'll get another appearance from him on a future show.
He's even better after four beers.
Nice.
All right, Adam, reach into the Film Spotting hat and please pick out this week's winner.
And the winner is Michael Watson in San Diego, California.
San Diego.
Congratulations. Email feedback at filmspotting.net and we will set you up with the DVD of your choice.
Monty used to act.
Well, I hardly say that. It's true I crept the boards in my youth, but I never really had it in my blood, and that's what's so essential, isn't it? Theatrical zeal in the veins.
Moving on now to this week's edition of Massacre Theater. Maybe not a scene from a film we love, but a scene from a film we like. And we definitely like some of the performances in it, as I'm sure many of our listeners do as well. There isn't really a hint we want to give here. It's going to be pretty obvious. It does tie in with something we are talking about or have talked about on this show.
I think you've said enough.
Okay, there you go. I started off, you give me the action.
And action.
You're a remarkable man. Your wife two times you. Plugs the guy, then tries to pin it on you. Most men would let a dame like that swing, but no, you're sticking by her. Makes you a hero in my eyes.
That's right. I'm a hero.
Did you bring the money?
I didn't do as well as I hoped, but I will, Mr. Blank. This is only $1,000, but there's money I borrowed from the guys at the garage. There's money from the building and loan fund, and that's all I got so far. But I'll give you money off my salary every week. I'll give you notes with interest. Double. Triple.
When you came to me yesterday, I didn't ask if she was guilty or innocent. I didn't ask if she was a drunk or a dope fiend. No, I said, you have money. You said yes. But you don't have money. I figure you're a dirty liar. I don't waste my time with dirty liars.
Look, I'm real sorry, Mr. Blank.
On the other hand, your devotion to your wife is really very, very touching. I took your wife's case, and I'll keep it, because I play square.
And scene. Very nicely done, Mr. Kempinar.
I tried. Maybe
I think you're getting better.
Your acting is rubbing off on me. Maddie, if you know what film we just massacred, email your name and location to feedback at filmspotting.net by Wednesday, January 9th.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next week's show. To get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
Hey, Adam and Maddie, this is Brian from St. Louis, Missouri, and I wanted to say that, Maddie, you are my new hero. I will now trust any recommendation that you throw my way, because this weekend I was able to finally see Juno, which is now my current favorite movie of the year. Thank you very much. And I owe it all to you guys. I thought it was going to be another knocked-up ripoff. You guys hit the nail on the head. It is a smart, witty little movie with a lot of heart and a ton of humanity. So thanks for the recommendation, guys, and keep on rocking the free world.
Joseph Kaufman from Louisville, Kentucky. Just been watching Away From Her, a movie I probably would never have found if you guys hadn't recommended it, and I want to thank you guys for doing that. I really enjoy the show, and thank you guys for putting it out. Can't wait for more episodes.
We kick off listener feedback there, Maddie, with a couple of great voicemails from listeners Brian in St. Louis, Joseph in Louisville. And it's always nice to hear people writing in, thanking us for some suggestions. You've obviously made a fan in Brian for your love and passion for the film Juno, a film I loved as well.
Yeah, I got a lot of people that said, you know, when I said I would marry Juno, the movie, mm-hmm. they wanted to see it. And that was really nice to hear.
That was a great line.
Well, I couldn't think of anything else to say. I had run out.
No, it was really good. And as I said to one listener who commented on that, I spend like 2.5 minutes trying to go through all the details of why Juno is great. You nail it in about 10 seconds. So that works out well. It's a good partnership, I guess. Joseph there, as I mentioned, in Louisville, seeing Away From Her and very happy to check that film out. Julie Christie, Gordon Pinsent, a great Canadian film from Sarah Pauley that is out on DVD now, mm-hmm. if you have the time to see that. We get into listener feedback, some of the emails that came in over the past few weeks where we've been doing our end-of-the-year awards lists. We've got our top five supporting actors and lead actors and actresses, and of course the best films of the year, which we did on our last show. And let's go ahead and dive into the mailbag with this one from A. Gates.
All right. His number five is Sunshine. It gets criticized for its ending, but I was thrilled by it and thought the movie had been setting it up all along. Number four, Michael Clayton. I think there was a lot more going on in this movie thematically than either of you guys gave it credit for, possibly.
I'd like to hear that explanation from A. Gates.
Number three, The Wind That Shakes the Barley. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Thank you, Maddie, for remembering this sobering drama. The love and conflict between brothers really shook me. Number two, Lars and the Real Girl, a film I have not seen,
me
Adam.
Neither.
I didn't have a deeper, more introspective response to any other film this year. I fell in love with a sex doll named Bianca, too. I'm looking forward to seeing it. I hope to catch up with on DVD.
Mm-hmm.
And number one, Zodiac. I'm glad to see Adam remembers it after so long. Bravo.
All right. Nice pick there of Zodiac. And I will mention our friend Michael Phillips, the fine film critic from the Chicago Tribune, who was our special guest on our last show, counting down his top 10 films of the year. On his top 10 worst films of the year, Lars and the Real Girl.
No way.
Yeah, he really disliked that movie, obviously. Another interesting note from A. Gates, who is in Uniontown, Ohio. He said in talking about Sunshine that maybe if Capone had made this list, that's Steve Procopi, who is from Ain't It Cool News and was a guest voicemailer and actually reviewed the film Sunshine with me on this show. He says maybe if Capone had made the list, Sunshine would have been on it. I'm not sure. I need to check out what Capone's list is. He was a big fan of Sunshine, the Danny Boyle film. Danny Boyle, a guest, of course, on Film Spotting. A. Gates was also giving you some love for including After the Wedding, a very good film. And the Thank You, Maddie parade rolls on with this one from Kirk Faber. I wanted to wholeheartedly thank Maddie for putting This Is England on his list of the best films of the year. Having seen it in the middle of the year without any hype or advertisement more than a trailer, I was amazed and taken away by it and can't wait to rewatch it again and again on DVD. This is the film from Shane Meadows about a young boy who gets caught up in a neo-Nazi group, basically becomes a skinhead, and his father has died in the Falklands War and obviously looking for some kind of a father figure there, and he finds it in this group. Once again, thank you, Maddie, for mentioning this gem of a film, which made my year of film going much more enjoyable. It is a very good film. You're number four, I believe.
Yeah, and I'm actually really looking forward to whatever Shane Meadows brings next, because we were turned on to one of his earlier films, Dead Man's Shoes, starring Toby Kebbell, actually.
Toby Kebbell from Control.
Another one of my favorite actors, new favorite actors. And I'm checking that out. I got it on my Netflix queue.
Well, I don't want to give anything away, but Shane Meadows and Dead Man's Shoes may be going to come up a little later in the show.
All right. Terrific.
Okay, that's a tease, what we call it here in the business.
Okay, our next one comes from Eric Munn from right here in the windy city of Chicago. He gives his top five supporting actors of the year. want to touch on a couple of them here. Number 5, John Colran Jr. in Black Snake Moan. John plays the Reverend R.L. in this funky film, and I think does a great job playing Samuel L. Jackson's Jiminy Cricket character. However, we also see he gets nervous when around Christina Ricci. And as much as I don't like Black Snake Moan and don't think it works, this performance, Eric is exactly right, is terrific. And I considered it, actually, for my top 5 list.
Yeah, it is a really good performance from that film. I agree.
All right, number 4, Gene Jones in No Country for Old Men. I agree with Maddie that this is one of those memorable scenes. Number 3, William Hurt in Mr. Brooks. I'm nervous that Mr. Hurt has become typecast as the evil, immoral bad guy in film since his nomination in A History of Violence, but it works. With all the problems Mr. Brooks has as a film, William Hurt's character keeps it afloat. Number 2, Robert Carlyle in 28 Weeks Later. Robert plays the father Don in this great horror flick. And number 1, Jeff Daniels in The Lookout. Jeff's character as the blind buddy of Joseph Gordon-Levitt in this great heist film is spot on. When Jeff puts his best work forward, it shows, and at no time do we see that Jeff is pretending to be someone blind, and if anything, is the only character that sees everything going on in the film. Some really nice picks there.
Overlooked.
I really did like William Hurt in Mr. Brooks. William Hurt is one of my favorite actors of all time, I have to say, and I really enjoyed him in that, and it is a bad film. Jeff Daniels in The Lookout. Yeah, he's great.
He is great in
that film.
Jeff
Daniels never disappoints.
No, that's true. He's always pretty much good. And, of course, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, I think, is very good in that film as well. William Hurt in Mr. Brooks, I have not seen it yet. I love William Hurt. I loved him in that one great scene from A History of Violence.
Oh,
I don't know
if
I love...
See, that's the one film he doesn't work for
me. I don't know if I love William Hurt enough, though, to check out Mr. Brooks.
You should.
Okay.
You definitely should. Appointment viewing.
With all those films I still have to see, you're saying...
Make room for it.
Fine time.
It's going to fly by.
Okay. Well, let's get to our last one here from our friend Sam McLean from Fur Online. He is in Cape Cod, I believe, Matt.
Beautiful Orleans, Cape Cod. A big shout out to Wellfleet and Provincetown as well.
Never been there myself, but we're going to read some of his picks there. He's got his list of his favorite leading men in performance, and this is another good list here with some performances that didn't get a lot of love from us. Number 5, Viggo Mortensen in Eastern Promises. You loved Viggo there,
terrific.
Even though
He's terrific.
You weren't a big fan of the Cronenberg film as a whole. I did like the film and Mortensen's performance. Number 4, Thomas Turgoose in This Is England. He is the boy in that film.
Yeah, this Very film good. Is just filled with great performances because that gang has to be so drawing. It has to be so electric. And also great is Stephen Graham as the head sort of skinhead.
Yeah, and you totally see why Thomas Turgoose would be drawn to him. Both are great. Number 3, a little bit of a controversial choice here maybe for me, Brad Pitt in The Assassination of Jesse James by the coward Robert Ford. I think it's a supporting performance. I think the film is really Casey Affleck's movie, and also I just don't think he's that compelling. No charisma. Talk about people following a gang. You don't see why they would want to follow him at all, other than the fact that he's really intimidating.
I think I mentioned this on the show when we reviewed it. Check him out as Jesse James in something like Thelma and Louise, an updated Jesse James, a charismatic grabber.
Yeah.
Here, he's just so flat.
And that comes from the character and the book, of course. We're seeing the darker side of Jesse James. We get that still. I don't think enough of that charisma came through. Number 2, Tommy Lee Jones in The Valley of Ayla, a movie from Paul Haggis that we had our issues with. I was actually surprised, though, how much I did like that film, and one of the reasons why Tommy Lee Jones is really great performance. I think Tommy Lee Jones is always good, though. I'm just a sucker for his acting. And then number 1, a really good choice here, Sam Riley in the movie Control, playing the troubled frontman of Joy Division, Ian Curtis, his first film.
Unbelievable.
A breakout performance, definitely from Sam Riley, who I had a chance to interview at Toronto. You can find that interview at filmspotting.net. But really, one of these standout performances of the year. I don't think he's probably going to get enough attention from, say, the Academy to get a nomination, but he definitely is good enough in the film to get it, I think. And Sam has a lot of inspired choices. I won't read all of them here, but in his supporting women performances, he mentions Zoe Bell from Death Proof, the New Zealand stunt woman, isn't that right, who we see at the end?
Is she the one on the hood
she's
of the car?
She's the one on the hood. I don't know if she's really that good of an actress, but she's pretty mesmerizing.
She's really good in that,
yeah. She is. So thank you to everyone for your great feedback. If you have a comment for us, email feedback@filmspotting.net.
Okay, time for one last quick break. Up next, the best date movies and documentaries of 2007, plus our top 5 most annoying performances of the year. We'll see if Jazz from Transformers gets on there, and much, much more. Please stay with us. Werewolves howl, vampires bite. What I let you
time to take a look at what is new on DVD coming out this Tuesday. I think a good week for DVDs, Maddie. 5 movies here, 4 of them, I think, definitely worth checking out. One of them is a film, maybe a really interesting miss. We'll start with Zodiac. It was my number 4 film of the year. Commentary by director David Fincher. This film was already released in a bare-bones kind of edition. Now it's out with all the bells and whistles, the commentary by Fincher, commentary by some of the actors, deleted scenes. So if you're a fan of that film or haven't seen it yet, check out Zodiac. Also out, the Danny Boyle film Sunshine, which is going to come up a little bit later in this show, I'm sure. Also out, Smiley Face. This is the Greg Araki pothead comedy with Anna Faris. Sam and I saw this movie at Sundance, and it is funny, worth checking out. I don't know that it got any kind of release. It's out now on DVD. It's very funny. Joshua, another film that Sam and I saw at Sundance, and this is from George Ratliff, his first film, a little horror film. Sam Rockwell's very good in it.
Sam Rockwell's very good
in
it.
Yeah, he is. Vera Farmiga's good in it as well, but the movie just missed for me. And then 310 to Yuma. This is a Western, the remake of the 50s Western. We both really like this movie until the ending. I'm hoping that in the audio commentary, James Mangold, the director, may explain what the hell he was thinking with
the ending
of that film.
I'm sure it's just going to go something along the lines of,
everything goes badly?
Yeah.
Maybe so. One quick note before we get to our donations, we did want to mention, speaking of Sundance, Maddie, you and I will be attending Sundance this year. I believe the dates will be there January 17th through the 22nd. And there is a thread in our message boards if you are in the area or plan on attending Sundance. Maybe you want to get together for a film spotting meetup like we had last year. Already had several listeners send us emails on that. We are interested, and if you go to the message boards, click on local events and meetups. You'll see there's some details there. We're looking at something maybe on Saturday the 19th. So really, that's the place to go. You can send us an email, but also go to the boards and you'll really get the latest information there.
Now it's time to give thanks to those listeners who were so generous and contributed some of their hard-earned money to Film Spotting this week. As always, we remain absolutely humbled by every donation thrown our way. And as a thank you, here are your patented Sam Van Halgren nicknames. Robin, Waiting for the Right Crime, a.k.a. Pot of Honey, a platinum donation. Thank you very much. Amanda, The Patient Pretender. Jordan, Discovering the Limits of My Genius. David, The Odd Single. Daniel, Serial Monogolist. J.D., In Touch with My Fallible Side. DR Productions in NYC, The Lords of Outerboro. Joe, Look Back in Argyle. Justin, Riverboat Casino Salesman. James, Gangland Downsizing. Gabrielle, Magic Realist. And George, Next Stop Deafening. That's a Silver Club member. Thank you very much. And also, Jonathan, The Ballynafay Baller Chesney. That's from your friend David Clausen in Belfast. And we want to mention this. We oftentimes get requests to give out little messages,
yes,
or shout outs to people. We are more than happy to, mm-hmm, oblige, but make sure to send in your donation and then send in an email, because there isn't a comment section on the donation form.
No, that's true. But it was very nice of David to want to give that gift on behalf of his friend there, Jonathan Chesney. They listen to the show every week. They do a little bowling night, and they talk about film spotting
in
Belfast.
I absolutely
love
Belfast.
And I've been there.
I love it when people include their location, because it really warms our hearts to see how many people all over the world are listening to Film Spotting.
Feels like hard time in a padded tomb.
Hi, this is Danny Boyle, director of Sunshine and Trainspotting, and you're listening to Film Spotting.
Hello, Film Spotting. This is Joshua Solomon from Coral Springs, giving feedback on the year-end show. I wanted to give you my top 10 films of the year, just to sort of compare and contrast, because I think I have a pretty interesting list and a different one than you'll see in a lot of other places. Number 10, Atonement. Number 9, Hot Fuzz. Number 8, The Namesake. Number 7, No Country for Old Men. Number 6, La Vie en Rose. Number 5, Bridge to Terabithia. No, I'm not kidding. Number 5 is really Bridge to Terabithia. I love that movie. 4, The Lookout. 3, The Lives of Others. 2, Knocked Up. And number 1 would be Before the Devil Knows You're Dead. I have had a great 2007 year discovering Film Spotting and listening. Thank you, and have a good holiday.
You are listening to Film Spotting with Adam and Maddie, and another great voicemail there, Maddie, from Josh with his top 10 of the year. Some good choices there. His number 1, though, Before the Devil Knows You're Dead, the Sidney Lumet film. We're going to hold off on comment on that. I think it's going to come up here a little bit later in one of these topics. We are doing our final look back at 2007. Got a lot of fun categories here we're going to dive into. It is a potpourri. Good choice of words there. And why don't we go ahead and start with our worst movies of the year. And before you get into your list, I do want to set it up simply by saying that it is true that we don't see a lot of the true dreck. That's one of the benefits of doing film spotting. We get to pick whatever we want to watch. We're going to pick the movies that we are most passionate about, that we think look the most interesting, and we can have a good discussion about. So, for example, I mentioned Michael Phillips, who was on our last show from the Chicago Tribune. I looked at his top 10 worst movies of the year. We've only seen two of his choices, Ocean's 13 and Shoot 'Em Up, which you actually haven't seen. Other movies on his list, movies like The Number 23, Bratz, Wild Hogs, Good Luck Chuck, I'm quite certain they're worse than some of the movies we're going to mention. But again, we have the benefit of not having to see those films. And I want to hear your list, Maddie. What were the worst movie-going experiences you had this year?
Okay, these are number 83 to number 87 on all the films I saw in 2007. I've never found a way to kill an afternoon that I didn't like, and so I actually went down and ranked every single one. So here we go. Number 83, Transformers. Number 84, Fracture. Number 85, Goya's Ghosts.
Milos Forman.
Oh, man, this thing is a dreck. Number 86, I would be surprised if this doesn't make your list, Across the Universe. And number 87, the worst film of 2007, Smokin' Aces.
I still have not seen Smokin' Aces, even with my boy Jeremy Piven in it.
Oh, you like Piven?
Sure, I do.
Oh, no.
He's great
even
on Entourage.
Bateman, and Bateman's in it.
Yeah.
And he can't salvage this thing.
Really?
It's an incomprehensible mess.
Okay. Well, now you have me more intrigued about it. Okay. Well, my list of worst movies of the year, I have to admit here, I looked back at my list, Maddie, I didn't give one star to any movie reviewed here on Film Spotting this year. The lowest I went was 2 stars. The only movies I gave 1 star to were a few films on the festival circuit that really haven't gotten a release yet or haven't gotten a release here in the States. I only really hated one film I'll get to here in a second, but for me, I've got 4 as well that I thought were the worst. Transformers was a pretty terrible experience for me, gave me a headache like most Michael Bay movies do. My number 3 here, Year of the Dog, the Mike White film.
Everybody likes that film.
Molly Shannon. Yeah, a lot of people do. I did not. I do really believe that Mike White loves these quirky, dysfunctional characters that he gives us, but some of the situations he puts his characters in are just too brutal to watch.
All filmmakers should be on notice. Don't bring your quirk into the film spotting zone.
Way too much quirk, and then not funny. That's when quirk is really bad here. My number 2 worst movie of the year, Pirates of the Caribbean 3, another film that gave me a headache. And number 1, a movie you haven't seen, and hopefully many of our listeners never will have to see, I saw it at Sundance. The worst film of the year, Hound Dog. This is the movie that most of you will know as the Dakota Fanning Gets Raped film.
Now, did that even get released?
I don't know. I had to put it because it's that terrible. It's the only movie that really enraged me enough that I wanted to get up and walk out of the theater. It was that bad, but then it became so bad, it almost became so bad it's good. It became kind of a mocking thing, like, how bad can this film get? It just kept getting lower and lower. So Hound Dog, my worst film of the year. We've been tearing down some movies, Maddie. Let's now talk about some of the movies we thought were the most underrated, maybe movies that didn't get enough love from critics.
Okay, yeah, these are films that I felt were overlooked. Number 4, Color Me Kubrick. This was pretty much a straight-to-DVD release, but I think it's worth it for Malkovich's performance. Number 3, The Hoax. I want more people to check this film out.
It's a decent film.
It really kind of flew under the radar. Number 2, Breach. I think a lot of people have forgotten this film, and I think Chris Cooper's performance merits consideration for supporting actor.
Absolutely.
And my number 1 overlooked is this little Russian film called The Italian. It's actually set in a boy's home in Russia, and it's about this little kid that goes on a journey to find his original mom. It's a really nice film.
It sounds like a nice film. I want to check that movie out, and all were great choices there. I agree. All a little bit underrated here. On my list, my first 3, Maddie, you're going to give me crap for some of these, but these first 3, I'm just saying, are a little bit underrated. Not hugely underrated by any stretch. Shoot 'Em Up, vulgar, violent. I had a lot of fun with it. The Mist, a movie we both did like a little bit, the Stephen King adaptation from Frank Darabont. I think it's definitely worth seeing. And if you look at its scores, it's pretty low in terms of how critics are receiving
it. HBO, it's late at night. The Mist comes on. You're not flipping away.
You are going to watch it. Here's the one that you're really going to roll your eyes at, though. Youth Without Youth.
Oh, eyes rolling right now.
Coppola film. It's just getting trashed. I still think it's worth seeing just to see what Coppola is doing visually in the movie. And here's the 2 I really do think are terribly underrated. Number two, Sunshine, the Danny Boyle film. Yes, I'm one of those people who thought it goes a little bit downhill at the end, but I think it's a really mesmerizing, kind of brilliant film, especially early on visually. And then number one, you had it as an overrated, and you're so dead wrong. One of the best films of the year, just outside my top 10, Black Snake Moan, from writer-director Craig Brewer. Great performances from Ricci and Samuel L. Jackson. I have not.
Put it in. Put it in and come back.
You think it's the rarefied
air of Sundance?
It's your homework
assignment for the week. Yeah.
Maybe.
I think you were just so giddy to be there.
Maybe. Maybe. And Samuel L. Jackson was there and Justin Timberlake was there. Maybe that influenced me, Maddie. You just never know. Let's get on then to date movies. I love that you brought this to the table, Maddie. This was one of the categories you wanted to add here. Best date movies and worst date movies. What do you got?
Okay. These are my best date movies. Not in any particular order. I Want Someone to Eat Cheese With, I think a great little Chicago film. Starter for 10, a great English film.
With my boy James McAvoy.
Yeah, he's terrific in it. Jane Austen Book Club, another homework assignment for you. Watch this with your wife, Adam. Once, a great film, of course, made our top 10 list. And Dan in Real Life. I just caught up with this film. I really liked it. Sweet little film.
We both did just watch that film with Steve Carell, Juliette Binoche in that movie. Definitely worth checking out. My best date movies, I have them in order here. Number five, Stardust, the film with Claire Danes. Waitress, Kerry Russell, amazing in that movie. Number three, Juno. I think a great, sweet date movie will, of course, make you laugh. Number two, Atonement. It could almost be on the worst date movies list because it's so bleak, but I think a great romance, one of the best we've had in a long time. And then number one, you can't beat Once. Nothing is sweeter and more like a great fable, a great love story than Once. So that's my best date movie. What about the worst date movies?
Yes, these are the movies under no circumstances should you see this with a significant other that you might be interested in. Number five, Margot at the Wedding, sort of the anti-Dan in Real Life. Number four, Crazy Love, a documentary about these two obsessive New Yorkers. My God. Number three, 2 Days in Paris. I like this film. I'm not suggesting I don't like these films.
Right.
But again, this one is sort of the anti-romantic comedy.
Sure.
I really like it, from Julie Delpy. Number two, After the Wedding. Again, a film I absolutely love, but don't see it with anybody you're trying to create a long-term relationship with. And number one, 300.
Yeah, 300 is actually my number five. Maybe not the best film to take your significant other to, or a prospective significant other. I also have Rescue Dawn, the Werner Herzog film. I think it's a great film, but there's not much romance in a Laotian prisoner of war camp. I don't think there's even a woman in the film. So I'm leaving Rescue Dawn there at number four. Number three, Lust Caution, the film from Ang Lee.
Well, it could get you worked up.
I'm saying it's either one of the best date movies of the year or the worst, because the fact is it's either going to get you very excited and titillated, truly, or it's going to cause some of the most uncomfortable, awkward moments that you'll ever have with a date. Lust Caution, very explicit sexual scenes in that film. Number two, Margot at the Wedding. I'm right there with you. Just 90 minutes of total dysfunction that will make you want to go hide in a cave somewhere and not interact with anyone. And then number one, even though I think it's a little bit underrated, Shoot 'Em Up. Again, over the top, vulgarity, violence, not good for a date movie. Maybe one of those prototypical kind of guy action movies. Discoveries then, Maddie. This is a category for people who aren't necessarily new on the scene, not necessarily breakthrough performers. These people may have been around for a while, but are new to us, and now we're very interested in them. Who were some of yours?
Right, and this is also, I'm including in here, sort of pleasant surprises, films that I was sort of pleasantly surprised by.
Okay.
Sarah Pauly, Away From Her. I've loved her as an actress, now I love her as a director. And here's one I was surprised by. Sicko, by Michael Moore. I was really surprised at how much fun I had at this film. I thought it was a really funny film. Number three, Suzanne Bier. She directed After the Wedding, of course, a film I've talked ad nauseum about. Number two, Diablo Cody and Juno, of course, the great screenwriter.
Yeah.
And number one, we've already discussed this, Shane Meadows, and This Is England.
Honestly, mate, you look sterling.
So am I in the gang now?
Well, not yet. Get your shirt on. Let's see your Ben Sherman, then.
I ain't got a Ben Sherman.
You telling me you've not got a shirt?
No, you just told me to get the jeans and the boots.
Are you having a laugh? You're going to have to come back next week. I'll see you, mate.
Honestly, have I really got to go?
Yeah, really, really.
Really.
Go on, mate. You're going to have to get off. Shut the door behind you. There's a good lad. Oh, hang on. Before you go, I forgot about something. Come here and give me a big hug. Come here, tell him. I'm really proud of you, mate. You look brilliant. Absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, a great list, and he's going to appear here on my list. This is the Ellen Page Memorial List. Of course, Ellen Page from Juno has been around for a little while and is now really on the scene. She really was new to us in Juno, even though I saw her briefly in X-Men 3 or whatever. But my discoveries, again, these are people who have been around a little while, but now I'm really intrigued by Marie-Josée Crosse from The Diving Bell and The Butterfly and Amy Ryan from Gone Baby Gone. Two supporting actresses there. Then I've got some directors. Juan Carlos Fresnadillo from 28 Weeks Later. Andrew Wagner from Starting Out in the Evening. I need to see his 2004 film, The Talent Given Us. Christian Mungiu, 4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days. Great film there from Romania. And then Shane Meadows, This Is England. I did just watch Dead Man's Shoes finally over the weekend. We've had listeners for 2 years who have written to us saying you have to see that film, and it's very good. I think I actually like This Is England better, but Paddy Considine is really good in it. It's a really interesting little revenge movie. Toby Kebbell is very good as well. So Shane Meadows, a guy who's been making films for a while. Dead Man's Shoes was 2002, but now he's definitely on our radar. And then finally, I know I went way over the five here, but two actors, Irfan Khan from The Namesake, Gordon Pinsent. Never seen their faces before in my life until this year. Gordon Pinsent from Away From Her. Two brilliant actors.
Beautifully elegant in both their performances.
What about disappointments? What about movies you went in with a lot of high expectations and they just didn't live up?
Okay, well, this one, music and lyrics. I'm a sucker for romantic comedies. And
pop,
I have to say, I love Hugh Grant. And yeah, the movie works sometimes, but I was really disappointed because I was sort of geared up for that one. Number three, Assassination of Jesse James. I think we've talked about that. Number two, B-Movie. Wow.
It's not good.
Not good.
No.
Not good.
I took Holden and Sophie to see it and was not impressed at all.
Unfortunately so. And my number one, The Darjeeling Limited. It's got some of my favorite people, of course, you know, Wilson. It's got Schwartzman, directed by Wes Anderson. And wow, I was just really underwhelmed by it.
Yeah, I was a little bit disappointed with Darjeeling as well, of course. My disappointment list, American Gangster, again, a movie I liked but just had really high expectations for. Redacted, the new Brian De Palma film. It's just terrible, and with the buzz coming out of Venice.
You were looking forward to a De Palma
film? I was,
film?
Only because it was getting such good buzz, and I thought, here, De Palma's finally going to reinvigorate himself, and we're going to have this great, edgy Iraq War movie. It's not edgy. It's not good. Number three, Fracture. I was looking forward to Ryan Gosling and Anthony Hopkins on screen. It's terrible. Number two, Across the Universe. I did want to see Julie Taymor doing the Beatles. It's bad. And my number one, let's go ahead and let one of our voicemailers explain my number one pick, though he's going to be really disappointed.
Hey, Adam and Maddie. This is a listener for about a year of Film Spotting, Matt Groves from La Mirada, California. And one film that I have loved this year that has been on my top 10 list consistently, that I reviewed along with a couple other films from my college newspaper, is Before the Devil Knows You're Dead. Great film, some of the best acting I've ever seen, great direction by Sidney Lumet, and I'm really sort of bummed that you haven't reviewed it yet.
My number one disappointment, Before the Devil Knows You're Dead, the Sidney Lumet film, another movie that could have gone in the overrated column. Mike Reif, one of our listeners, wrote in and said, why haven't we reviewed it? Did it never come to Chicago? It did. We just caught up with it late. And he says, it's an American masterpiece, as good as Into the Wild and Headed and Shoulders Above, yes, No Country for Old Men.
Wow.
Mike, those are fighting words. I don't know. I love Lumet, and yet something about this movie, it just seemed to me like a very good actor studio exercise, filmed actor studio exercise. You get to see Philip Seymour Hoffman do his Philip Seymour Hoffman thing, but then you got to watch Ethan Hawke, who I know it's fashionable to rip on Ethan Hawke. I actually like him as an actor. In this movie, the fact that he chooses to play the weaker brother as, I'll use the politically correct term, slow, was a really bad choice. It just doesn't work. I didn't care about any of them. Marissa Tomei, poor Marissa Tomei. She's getting praise for this performance. What performance? Yeah. She basically just has to be topless the whole film. I felt sorry for her.
Yeah, and actually, my biggest annoyance with this film, and you kind of touched on it, it's that Philip Seymour Hoffman, of course, does his Philip Seymour Hoffman thing, and I think that encourages Albert Finney to try and match him, and Albert Finney is unwatchably bad because he tries to go so over the top, and an unrestrained Albert Finney is not something I want to be watching. No.
Yeah, I'm not saying the movie doesn't have its merits. I'm not saying it's a terrible film. In fact, I think we're both saying, you know, it's definitely worth seeing, check it out, but it's not a masterpiece, not even close.
Well, he's done his bank heist masterpiece with Dog Day Afternoon. I don't understand why he was doing this. And he sort of incorporates a little Tarantino sort of Pinterest storytelling, and all of it just sort of doesn't work.
That's another thing that doesn't work. You're absolutely right, is the fractured, disjointed, nonlinear, I'm sorry, that's the word I'm looking for. The nonlinear storyline doesn't add anything, and so I didn't really see what the point was. So that is my number one, unfortunately, disappointment, Before the Devil Knows You're Dead. Let's get to the big finish here, Maddie. We've got our documentaries and annoying performances. What were your favorite docs?
Okay, in no particular order, In the Shadow of the Moon, of course, the moon landing story. Unreasonable Man about
Ralph Nader.
About Ralph Nader. Air Guitar Nation. A lot of people love King of Kong. I think Air Guitar Nation does the same thing for air guitar that King of Kong did for
Donkey Kong.
Donkey Kong. Number three, Lake of Fire. This is a really hard documentary to talk about, let alone recommend, but I really did. I will just say I'm really glad I saw this film. And, of course, King of Kong. I really did like that film.
Okay. Well, I've also got in my documentaries some overlap there. I've got My Kid Could Paint That, a movie I did have some issues with, but definitely worth checking out. Joe Strummer, The Future is Unwritten, I liked more than you, Maddie. Then I've got a quick tie with two political films that couldn't be more opposites in terms of their approach, Sicko, the Michael Moore movie, and Charles Ferguson's No End in Sight, great Iraq War doc. Lake of Fire, I'm with you. Tony Kaye's movie about abortion. I think if you're remotely interested in that issue at all, you have to see this movie. It's a hard sit. You're absolutely right. And then The King of Kong was a great doc. Annoying performances, though. This should be a fun one. Which performances? Do you have five of them here or only a few?
I've got four.
Really just annoyed you to no end.
Jonah Hill in Walk Hard.
He's bad.
Oh, my gosh.
He's there briefly, but he's not good.
A lot of actors get accused of playing themselves. Jonah Hill is playing himself, and basically it's just a Cartman character, a guy with Tourette's. Not interesting to watch. Doesn't help the film at all. Number three, Topher Grace, a guy I usually love.
I love Topher Grace.
He's so bad in Spider-Man 3.
He's got a bad character, though.
Oh well, but if you're getting a chance to play Venom, come on, embrace that. Number two, John Travolta in Hairspray. Why? It just boggles the mind. Number one, the cast of Southland Tales. I'm sorry. You know how SAG gives Best Ensemble of the Year? This is probably the most disjointed ensemble. I don't think any of them knew they were in the same movie.
That's a good point. I think you're actually right there. My annoying performances, this is really nitpicking, but Roger Bart in American Gangster. He has one scene where he has to come in and give Russell Crowe what for over something he did wrong. He's like a federal agent or something. He's terrible in that. And I'll pair that with Jordan Ladd, who plays Shanna in Death Proof. She's terrible in Death Proof. She's the one weak link in that ensemble of girls in Quentin Tarantino's Death Proof. Really drove me crazy. Jake Gyllenhaal and Reese Witherspoon, a tie for Rendition. Both annoying. Laura Linney, the great Laura Linney for The Savages, drove me nuts. Ethan Hawke, already touched on him from Before the Devil Knows You're Dead. Just bad choices throughout. And then number one, we disagreed on this, but Joaquin Phoenix in We Own the Night totally derailed that film alone with his performance.
I think we should do a joint list right here. Top three dead-eyed performances of the year.
Yeah.
Number three, the cast of Beowulf. Number two, I think I'd go with Joaquin Phoenix. Number one, you're absolutely Gyllenhaal.
Yeah, it has to be. Okay, well, we're finally here at the end, Maddie, and I love this category you came up with. Why don't you explain it to our listeners?
Well, I'm going with the Harvey Keitel Memorial List Best Male Frontal Nudity of the Year. And the fact of the matter is we were going to do the steamiest scenes of the year, and I didn't want to play into that stereotype.
No.
We're already two white film geeks. Let's not play up that misogynistic end. And of course, it is a double standard in Hollywood. Some of our best actresses are asked to get naked in what? In the name of vulnerability?
Uh-huh.
And of course, our best actors never, ever are asked to do that. So here they are, the people that were brave enough to do that. Number four, some guy in Walk Hard. You'll know what scene I'm talking
about. Will.
Number three, Jean-Louis Coluc in Lady Chatterley's Lover. A good film that we haven't really talked about.
No.
And number two, Viggo in Eastern Promises.
Great fight scene in the nude.
Number one, Bart Simpson in the Simpsons movie. I think that was my favorite bit from that movie.
Maybe so. There are a lot of good bits, though, I think, in the Simpsons movie. And there's so many others we could get to here. I wanted to get into my villains list, but really we could go on and on talking about the year in cinema. I think we both agree it was a very good year for cinema, but now bring on 2008.
And with that, we officially say goodbye to 2007. Please send your lists or any other feedback about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net.
Opening wide this weekend, the horror movie One Missed Call, that'll be One Missed Film, and expanding to more screens in limited release, Juno, Atonement, and The Orphanage. We say go see all three of those films. Juno and Atonement were both on my top 10 of the year, and again, The Orphanage is slated to go wide Friday the 11th.
Okay, on next week's show, we'll review Paul Thomas Anderson's There Will Be Blood with Daniel Day-Lewis, spend a few minutes on The Bucket List with Morgan Freeman and Jack Nicholson, and share our top five most anticipated movies of 2008. It's going to be really hard to top 2007.
That's true. We may only get into our top five most anticipated spring movies. We'll see how that shakes out next week. We want to say thanks to our listeners, volunteers, Alex, Angela, Frank, and Candace. Special thanks to Joe Dassault, Ron Jones, and Tori Malatia at Chicago Public Radio, and also to Chuck Prophet for this week's music. Learn more at chuckprophet.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Maddie Robinson. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is brought to you by Spout. Visit filmspotting.spout.com to discuss this episode.